Greetings. You are listening to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge. It is Friday, June the 24th. Thanks so much for listening. We seek every week to inform you about issues you feel are important, update you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspire you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movement made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that has always and will continue to create real change. Last week was occupied with a number of activities related to two upcoming events that we have been intimately involved in, three upcoming events actually, those surrounding the Republican National Convention and the deadline for turning in petitions for the Move to Amend efforts in a couple of different communities, most notably in Cleveland. Toward that end, this past Saturday, there was efforts in both Cleveland and in South Euclid to have organized petitioning that took place. It was a grand day weather-wise, good day to be out, and pretty successful in gathering signatures in both days. In the case of Cleveland, there was a mass petition day, met at initially Cleveland Friends Meeting House on Magnolia Road in University Circle. People fanned out from there and collectively gathered more than 300 signatures on Saturday. So now Cleveland folks are up to almost 6,700 signatures collected. The goal is by what is going to be next weekend, 7,500. So coming close to that goal, and hopefully it'll be surpassed and can be with certainly help from those who still have petitions or those like you who may not have yet a petition, but for at least 1 hour over the next week, be willing to help out. More on that in a minute. In South Euclid, there was an effort as well. I went over and for a couple of hours, there was something called Rock the Block on Mayfield, where one of the lanes was closed off, and organizations in town had tables. People came, restaurants were open, and turned out to be a pretty good place to gather signatures there as well. They need far fewer signatures. Have a little longer period of time to collect them, more like the middle of July. So they are well on their way toward their goal as well. So that was a good day in both communities in gathering signatures. Sunday was the weekly, what's turning out to be weekly meeting of the People's Justice and Peace Convention Planning Group. Just as a reminder for those individuals that want to keep up with what is going on, who is planning to speak, workshops that are in the works, and how you can register, please go to the website pjpc2016.org. That's www.pjpc2016.org. The PJPC, of course, stands for People's Justice and Peace Convention, which is scheduled to take place July 15 through 17 in Cleveland, two different venues. Lots of planned speakers, but also, most importantly, opportunities for participants to weigh in and help shape and develop a people's platform for justice, peace, nonviolence, democracy, sustainability across the board that will be presented to the representatives of both the Republican and Democratic National Conventions occurring in mid to late July. So those are the two main things. Most of the rest of the week was focused on collecting signatures and the eye-watering activity of checking those petitions that have been turned in Cleveland. We spent a lot of time this week, volunteers in our office, myself, Leah Davis, administrative assistant, just poring over those petitions, trying to salvage as many as humanly can signatures and entries by making sure that those individual entries are readable, clear, concise, and accurate. And so just by doing that, we have saved probably scores at this point so far. We're still only about halfway done. We got to really increase the effort because the deadline is fast approaching. So that was the better part of a lot of the rest of the week spent at least in AFSC in support of the Cleveland Initiative. and South Euclid as well. Well, turning now to events and activities coming up next week, a lot of more of the same. Sunday is the weekly meeting of the People's Justice and Peace Convention, 1:30 p.m., North Presbyterian Church, 4515 Superior. It's not too late to help, to attend, to participate, to help out, to do what you can to help this pretty daunting task of trying to pull off a major convention with not all that many resources and the like. If you're willing to contribute, that would be great as well. Contact our office, 330-928-2301. We can direct you to how you can do that. So that's Sunday. This upcoming Monday on the 27th, 1 p.m., is the End Poverty Now planning meeting, March for Economic Justice, 1 p.m., 3500 Lorraine Avenue in Cleveland. If you have been following the news, a federal judge threw out the so-called plans or guidelines or requirements for the so-called protest march route that the city and who knows whom in the federal government developed that was completely ridiculous and would have taken us far outside hearing distance to be relevant, to be heard, to be seen by delegates at the RNC at times that do not coincide with when most of the delegates at the RNC will be attending. So it was, I think, a very good move on the part of the judge to throw out the plan. There are now negotiations going on between representatives of the End Poverty Now march and the city over something that is reasonable in trying to allow us access in close proximity at a time that is one that will be relevant, will be legitimate, and hopefully will be seen and heard by RNC delegates. So that is the plan, and certainly we'll be talking more about that at that meeting. Again, that's Monday the 27th at 1 p.m., 3500 Lorraine Avenue in Cleveland. Tuesday in the evening at beginning 6 p.m. at East Mount Zion Baptist Church is a what's being called a field hearing to save our public postal service. The gathering is being organized by something called a Grand Alliance to Save Our Public Postal Service, made up of national, state, and local organizations, including ours, the American Friends Service Committee, to focus on different elements and aspects that we feel collectively are important, that make the public postal service one deserving of continuation of our support, and in a good number of instances, of expansion. Most notably, to expand the postal service to include minimal amounts of financial services that can be done administratively without an act of Congress. There's other more ambitious campaigns that may be raised, but may not necessarily be at the center of this public hearing that involves a full-scale effort at expanding postal services at post offices around the country to include large-scale financial services and, if you will, to become a full-fledged virtual bank. Some of those items will be brought up of how the Postal Service can be expanded to include such services in a stepping stone fashion, at least minimally, to provide some basic financial services for those who live in inner cities that can be described as financial banking deserts, where individuals are forced to go to payday loan organizations that then are charge an exorbitant percentage for loans and for other sort of minimal banking services. That's not needed, particularly if banks can, banking services minimally can be provide financial services by the Postal Service. So all of that is going to be brought up and testimony received. I am one of those who will be providing testimony along with about five or six others to a group of panelists that include Representative Marcy Kaptur, individual connected retired president of the Postal Workers Union, and others. So that is going to, again, take place this Tuesday, June 28th, beginning at 6 p.m., 9990 Euclid Avenue. That's east of Mount Zion Baptist Church, 9990 Euclid Avenue in Cleveland. For the rest of the week, we will be out petitioning. Deadline for the Cleveland petition turn-in is a week from tomorrow, July the 2nd. So this is crunch time. If you have a petition, please go out and get, if you can, even just another 10 signatures. If you don't have one, we can get you one. And if you can get 10 signatures, that would be great. Feel free to contact our office, 330-928-2301, 330-928-2301. So those are the activities coming up for next week. This is Greg Coleridge with the Northeast Ohio American Friends Service Committee. Joining us today is Debbie Silverstein, State Director of SPAN Ohio, which stands for Single Payer Action Network of Ohio, which is part of a national network promoting health care as a human right. Thanks so much, Deb, for being our guest, and welcome.
Well, my pleasure for being your guest, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
So, single payer health care. We hear it a lot in the mainstream media. It's been sometimes accurately defined, many times not. So why don't you define what it is, how it is like, for example, Medicare, how it's different. Please define single payer health care.
Well, to start out with, Medicare is a single-payer program. What single-payer is primarily a financing mechanism for health care where we pay in, by way of taxes, into a single entity. In the case of Medicare, it's into the government, but you could set up a quasi-public agency to handle it. And they pay all the bills, and that's why it says single-payer. Now, as far as the medical care that you get, that pretty much remains the same. You get that from private providers, or you can get it from public providers, and we have plenty of those, that exist in our current melange of systems here in the United States. But basically, it's financing. You have the free choice of doctors and hospitals under that plan, so you go to the doctor you want, and you go to the hospital that you want.
We oftentimes hear single payer kind of bunched together with other systems, most notably I have heard, maybe you as well, of the Canadian system and others that limit the choice of medical providers. So from what you're saying, single payer, by focusing exclusively on the finance element, is not one and the same as those systems that would limit medical providers.
That's not the intent of the single-payer movement, to limit medical providers. And if you look at Medicare, traditional Medicare does not limit your provider. I mean, the only thing that would limit you is whether the provider accepts Medicare or not. And most do accept it, because when you look at health care in the United States, who are the greatest users of health care? That's going to be your elderly, because everyone on Medicare has an end-of-life experience. End-of-life illness. So Medicare covers all of that. I'm not sure which countries limit your choice of physician, but I do know that when my sister lived in Canada, she didn't have a limit on which physician she went to. It was just whether they were accepting new patients or they could get her in at the time that they needed. And in most cases, the physician she chose could do so.
Right.
No need to limit the choice of the physician under a single-payer program, because the choice of the physician is something that's really highly personal, and your health is dependent upon it, because there has to be a good fit between the patient and the doctor.
So very much single-payer would be an extension, as has often been sometimes described, as Medicare for all, an extension from just seniors to the entire population.
Absolutely. And in fact, Medicare, when it was first passed, was designed to be extended in just that manner. They, at the time, they wanted a national health insurance program, but they did not think they could get it passed, so they focused on those that they knew they could get the votes for, and that was the elderly for Medicare. And back in those days, we cared about the poor, so we passed Medicaid at the same time. The idea was that we could expand it, maybe starting with kiddie care that covered children from 1 to 18, and then later it would be a real easy thing to just expand that coverage from 19 to 64, because those are generally your very healthy populations and very cheap to cover and that type of thing. But the founders of Medicare, those that created Medicare and built that program, really had that idea in mind. What most of the programs do that advocate Medicare for All is they also put in the improved part. And there's no doubt that we need some improvements to Medicare. There's no system on the earth that is foolproof and 100% perfect. But and Medicare works very well, but we need to improve the coverage. We need to include all parts of the body, such as your eyes, such as your teeth, and your ears, hearing aids. And we also need to do something very, very important, and that is to allow Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs. Medicare is specifically prohibited from doing that by the ACA and by the Medicare Part D, the prescription drug plan bill that was passed under George Bush.
Well, don't we, Deb, have a national health plan? Isn't this Affordable Care Act or Obamacare such a national health system?
No, not really, because it was not designed to cover everybody. When they passed that, they knew that there would be people that would still be left out. And, you know, what it does is it expands health insurance to more people, but it doesn't necessarily expand care. And that's because of some of the provisions that were in the bill. You know, the idea was to make health insurance cheaper, and the only way to do that is by raising deductibles and adding on copays. And so what it's actually done is it has shifted the cost of health care from the insurers and employers that provided it onto the individual. And the individuals can't afford it, and we have seen, you know, a decrease in health care spending. That's not because of the ACA. That's because people aren't getting the care they need. We still have a large percentage, and a lot of them are insured, that are declining prescriptions, not getting tests they needed, not seeing doctors when they need to. You know, everyone talks about how we need skin in the game. We already had the most skin in the game as far as out-of-pocket costs, and it had done nothing to curb the rise in those costs. What it does is it prevents people from seeking necessary care at the first opportunity when things are usually easier to treat and cheaper to treat. People will wait until there's a crisis in order to seek care. You know, no, that's not a national health insurance plan. That's a piecemeal plan. It's a Band-Aid approach that was put on a failing system, and it's not really doing the job intended of controlling costs.
And ours is it not in this country, a healthcare system that is the most expensive on the planet certainly not providing the best care.
That's absolutely correct. When you look at healthcare statistics such as infant mortality, we've got some places here in the United States where infant mortality rates rival that of third world nations. That's nothing for America to be proud of. An interesting thing that we also have is a rise in maternal mortality, deaths during childbearing or childbirth. Most other countries have seen a decline in this. The United States is seeing an increase in this. Our longevity is not as great, and there's a lot of other health indicators that show that we are not getting the job done. And part of that is because of the piecemeal effect of our numerous healthcare systems. You know, and I keep saying that, and that's because we do not have a unified system. We don't have a healthcare plan or a public plan, public policy that really works for this country and the number of people that we have in it. When you think about it, we've got Medicare that covers the elderly. We've got Medicaid, which covers some of the poor. We have the Veterans Administration, Veterans Health Program, which covers some of the vets. Some of them live way too far away to take advantage of it. Some of them live in very rural places, and not all veterans are eligible for the Veterans Health Program. We've got the Indian Health Services. We've got CHIP. We've got, you know, a number of other things. Plus, we've got employer-sponsored insurance, and then we've got the individual market. And we really fall down on the individual market. That's where people get left out because they can't afford the premiums. I mean, the average cost for a family of four these days is around $25,000. You know, when median household income is $50,000, no family can afford to spend half their income on health insurance.
How does the current system that exists in the United States serve as a economic deterrent, if you will, in the marketplace for employers who have to bear some of the costs that their international competitors, say in Europe, do not have to bear, since some of these other countries have a public health system?
It really actually serves as a big deterrent economically in a number of ways, not just in job creation and employment. It certainly does there, and I know of a number of places where they cut their employees' hours to 29 hours per week, you know, hoping to get under that cap of having to provide insurance because of the cost. There's a number of small businesses that they've gone under because of the cost of providing health insurance, or they don't provide it, but that costs them because they can't compete for the employees they really want. You know, the employees they want are always looking for those big city jobs, that we used to call them, to provide those benefits. And obviously, most of us would want that through our employer. It's expected. You know, and how many times have people heard, get a job, you know, when we talked about, you know, the uninsured, expectation is that we'll have it. The other part of that is that because healthcare in this country costs much, that it does have a tendency to constrict the economy as a whole. We're putting almost 18% of our gross domestic product into healthcare, whereas other developed nations are putting in 11% to 12%. And when we put that much into healthcare, those are dollars that we don't have to spend on other goods and services. And you have to understand that the economy is driven about 70% by consumer demand. You can give all the tax breaks you want to companies and corporations, but if the consumers, if the vast majority of Americans can't afford to buy those goods and services, they're not going to create more goods, they're not going to produce more goods or provide more services and hire more people, that, you know, no one is going to buy the product or good. You know, it's a craziness. So we have that aspect of it too, you know, besides just the fact that it's very expensive to employers, and we are in a global marketplace, and it's hard for our employers to compete. When you look at the cost of producing a car, Ontario, Canada, for a long time led the United States in production of automobiles, but it was $1,500 a car less to produce it there because of the healthcare system in Canada.
Right. So Canada has a national health care system. What other nations have something that would be something akin to a single-payer system?
Britain has a single-payer system. It's the national health program that they have over there. Now, theirs is true socialized medicine, as is the VA, because the doctors and hospitals, the doctors are employed by the government, and the hospitals are owned by the government. And that's the same case in the VA. That is socialized medicine. You know, Canada, with its single-payer system, it's partially socialized. Only the financing part is socialized because it's more economical, but the rest of it is private. Taiwan patterned theirs. They went looking to – they knew they needed to do something. They first looked at the U.S. and said, no way, that's too expensive. But they did go after the U.S. Medicare system, and they said, there's an efficient system, and that's what they patterned their healthcare system after, and they have a single-payer program. Other countries have some combinations. If they have private insurance, it's very, very highly regulated, and it is not allowed to be for profit. And that does exist in some countries such as Switzerland, and I believe in somewhat in France. France is about 80% public supported and then 20% privately paid. And employers a lot of times pick up that 20% in that. So most developed nations have a universal health care system where everyone is covered that is very highly public support.
So they can be described as everyone in, right? Isn't this what Spann and others say? Everyone in, nobody out.
Absolutely. And actually, that benefits the system and helps bring down costs, because when you include everybody, then everyone is covered and everyone is getting the care that they need right along. When you exclude people, you still have to care for them. The law does not allow us to turn them away. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand that, but that's part of, it's called EMTALA, and that was signed into law, by the way, by Ronald Reagan. But, you know, emergency rooms have to accept patients when they come in a crisis. And so with your uninsured, quite often that's what happens, is they show up at the emergency room in a crisis. They will treat and stabilize that person until they can leave the hospital, and then they'll go on their way. And, you know, the uninsured, they can't pay for that. So we end up paying for that through public dollars as well. And it also, you know, equates to higher costs to us for private insurance. Anytime you add a gatekeeper to the system to exclude somebody, you're increasing the bureaucracy, you're increasing the waste, the administrative waste to the system.
And those gatekeepers in our system are those insurance corporations.
They're the insurance corporations. There's some that are federal regulations, for example, under the ACA. Even immigrants that are documented are not allowed to participate until they've been here for 5 years. Well, what do they do for health care?
That seems
kind of silly on my part, you know, to me. And, of course, the undocumented are not allowed to participate in the ACA or any of the public programs that we have. But then we don't just throw them away and we don't pile dead bodies up by the side of the road. You know, we're not that kind of a society, no matter what we've heard lately.
Yeah, right. So who supports universal health care, single-payer system in this country in terms of, say, professionals? What about medical establishment? Where are doctors, nurses, others sort of on the front lines of the medical system? And then what about the general public? What do polls say about public support for public health care?
Well, actually, both of them are positives towards that movement. There's a an organization called Physicians for a National Health Program, and it started out small, but they've got over 20,000 members now, and they have conducted polls from time to time. And they started out with their support was mainly among primary care physicians, but, of course, they're the ones that saw everybody in that. And, you know, the specialists were income protecting and they weren't so quick to jump on the bandwagon. But even among the specialists in the last few years, the support for single payer has increased. And the last poll they did showed 60% support among the medical profession overall, and I think it's about 80% for primary care and ER doctors. Among the public, the latest poll showed 58% support, and that's about 81% Democrats, somewhere a little over 50% for independents, but surprisingly an increasing amount of Republican voters are coming out in favor of a single-payer plan, and that was up to 41%, which is a huge increase among that voting group there. And personally, among my friends that I know that are Republican voters, they do support a single-payer plan because they recognize the fiscal conservancy that's involved and the benefits of business.
So with this growing
there's growing public support for Medicare for All. It's been, you know, the idea's been around for a long time, and we came very, very close in the past. And it was Ronald Reagan that went and recorded his record, and they had all these coffee clatches. The doctor's wives held the coffee clatches about the evils of Medicare. And at that point in time, public support for a national health program fell quite a bit. Also back during the Truman presidency, the same type of thing happened. You know, if we were to do this, we'd never be free men again, and we'd have to go out and work in the wheat fields and that sort of thing. At this point, I'd be happy to work in the wheat fields just to be able to see the doctor when I needed to.
Yes, very much so. Well, Deb, with this growing public support that is increasingly bipartisan for such a system, why don't we have it? What are the impediments, the cultural, the economic, the political, for not having a single payer or any kind of truly genuine, authentic universal health care?
I think, you know, with the public turning around, I think we're turning one of the cultural impediments, which was, I've got mine, you take care of yourself, why should I pay for you, even though those people didn't understand they already were. Uh-huh. And that's the way insurance works. You know, when you look at the cost of insurance, what I'm paying in insurance, I don't use that much. I don't get that much benefit out. But what my premium is doing is going to pay for other people that are sicker. And someday, other people's premiums will pay for me. And that's the way insurance pools work.
Mm-hmm. And for everything, not just health care, right?
Not just health care. That's the way auto insurance works. That's mm-hmm. I mean, I've paid the auto insurance for 35, 40 years and never made a claim. So mm-hmm. that money's going somewhere. It's not all going to decorate Nationwide's new offices or anything like that. If you really want to look at the reason, though, look at what happened during the debates over the ACA, and you need to follow the money. You know, in that case, the insurers pretended to be working to promote health care reform with the Obama administration, but they were secretly funneling money to the Chamber of Commerce to run ads against it. So they were playing both sides of the fence. And you had major lobbyists that were spending huge, huge money during that debate to derail health care plans. In fact, that was one of the biggest lobbying efforts that ever existed in the United States. Probably the second biggest was during the Truman years when he tried to get a national health plan through, and that was the other huge, big lobbying effort in order to defeat that one. And it's business entities trying to protect their profits. You know, so we're putting the profits of the few over the benefit of all of the people in that. So it's a money issue. It's the way we do politics here in the United States. You know, look at what just happened with the recent vote on gun control, despite Orlando.
That's right. The lobbyists weigh in, the contributors weigh in and are able to stymie, or in the case of Affordable Care Act, shift it to where even when something happens, the major investors seem to profit from it, as it is the case here, where insurance companies, you know, they benefit from the system where you have to have medical insurance.
Yes. You know, and the other thing that I would add in there is that you need to have elected officials that have a spine. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't do anything unless they're forced to by massive public opinion. And so it does take the masses of Americans to get out there and to force their hand on some of these issues. You know, you have to be in their face all the time. And remember, they do work for you.
That's right. So what is SPAN doing to try to create this massive public support for single payer in the state and with allies elsewhere in Ohio and across the country?
We are working to do that. We're in a massive base building phase right now, but our goal is to put an issue on the ballot in 2020. And this would be a constitutional amendment that we would create a healthcare system that includes all Ohioans, that is publicly funded, that provides equity with a fair allocation of resources and services to meet the needs of the people, not the bean counters, and that would be accountable to the people, not to Wall Street shareholders, you know, with public accountability and transparency. And the biggest thing is that it would allow for public participation in all aspects of the healthcare system. Not just the interaction between you and your doctor, but in as far as coverage limits and so on and so forth, those things would provide for public participation and public transparency. So that's our goal, is to get that passed in 2020. And I do know Oregon is planning to go on the ballot with something similar at the same time, and I think there's one other western state as well. And we're keeping our eyes on Colorado this fall, because Colorado is going to have that issue on the ballot as well, and we will take a real close look at their campaign. And, you know, so that we can avoid some of the pitfalls, and we know what the objections are going to be. And so far in Colorado, it's the fact that it's publicly funded and it's going to take tax money. That we can easily answer, because the tax money we'll pay is far less than what we're paying in deductibles, copays, and premiums right now.
Okay. So that's a four-year plan between 2016 to 2020. If individuals want to become more involved, find out what Span Ohio is doing, how can that happen?
Well, they can go to our webpage, www.spanohio.org, and they can sign up to join us. They can also look there and find their regional coordinator. There's contact information for the regional coordinator, and they can give them a phone call or email them and let them know that they want to get active and want to get involved. If they would like to do that, they can contact me. My contact information is on the webpage, or they can email me at span@spanohio.org. And we've got some activities that people can do. We've got a wonderful documentary called Fix It that was produced by a business owner. And it really does the business case for single payer, but it's also a good general explanation of what the whole system is about and why we want it. You know, what we can do, you could do home parties and do showings of Fix It to help educate friends and relatives and neighbors as well. And you can get involved in a more active role. Span Ohio will be represented in Cleveland this July at the End Poverty Now March and at the People's Convention. And we would urge people to come to those events and join with us.
Well, terrific. That video documentary is well worth the viewing, and Span Ohio is well worth the involvement. So, Deb, thanks so much for taking the time, and as we work together to promote single-payer health care, to democratize and humanize our health care system, which is so very much needed, as well as to democratize and humanize so much of the rest of our economic and social agenda.
Well, they're all related, Greg, so yes, we do need to work together.
Yep. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our website is afsc.org/Akron. Facebook page, facebook.com/NEOAFSC. Program blog, northeastohioafsc.wordpress.com. My blog, createforalldemocracy.wordpress.com. Until next week, onward for justice, peace, and democracy.